SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Monday. Race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM online. And at our website, stevebick.com, it is, of course, the last week of the broadcast year. Normally, you know, kind of a wrap up and tie it all up with a ribbon. And put the finishing touches on the year, and we'll do all of that. But at the same time, we do have kind of a solemn occasion as well for this morning, the first half of the show in particular, with the word of Bob Coghlan's passing. On Saturday, and we'll talk to Adam, his son, who has carried on what is a family business, essentially, multi-generation for decades and decades in New York, and really a privilege to get to know Bob these last 20 years. And even though he hadn't been at Saratoga the last couple of summers, he would hang around the office, and he would still come and shoot, particularly big races. And his work is really the defining photography of the second half of the 20th century in our game. Any number of iconic imagery through his lens, and obviously the most famous photo is always going to be of his, is always going to be the 31 lengths, Ron Turcott looking back on Secretariat. But there's so much more, and I know that Adam, when he joins us, doesn't want to take the focus away from the Secretariat shot, but I mean, there were decades of work already registered for Bob Coghlan in advance of that, and there were so many other just fabulous pictures. The one, I should have taken it off the wall and put it in front of me. Maybe I'll do that. I'll run and do that. Somehow, I don't know how I can pull that off, but it's just in the other room. But the savage from the 1980 Tremont that is, in fact, has outsold. It was at the retail shop that Bob and wife Roz manned at Saratoga every summer. That always the Savage has outsold the Secretariat shot. But there's so many more. I told Adam the famous gelding shot of John Henry at Belmont. Why I didn't realize that was a picture that Bob took. It was pretty ridiculous that I didn't register to me. But the Kelso Forgo John Henry, the great gelding shot that he took. There's so much to talk about with Adam. So I shouldn't go too far with this because we'll let Adam walk you through his incredible career and life. Because you know, when you're taking pictures for a living, you're recording history, and there's a weighty element to what Bob did, and every quote you see of his is very self-effacing, as if he didn't have anything to do other than point and click. Which is just silly. And what's very interesting, and I want Adam to flesh this out, his father literally was a bridge, you know, from the single frame capture to the digital age in photography. There's probably very few. I mean, there's a lot of photographers that have been around, you know, for a long time, but not one that, you know, so, you know, perfectly. He was 88 years old, and he only stopped really shooting, I mean, full time 10 years ago. So he was 78. I mean, and he started as a teenager. So, I mean, 60 years, literally from 1950, essentially, 52, I think, to 2013. It's amazing. We'll also hear from Skip Dickstein, and Skip shot alongside, really for the only now with Skip semi-retired, I mean, the breadth of Skip's career, essentially, that he shot alongside Bob. Alan Gutterman is going to join us. I just saw Alan 10 days ago or whatever it was, the weekend in L.A. And Alan Gutterman, longtime turf publicist and one of the greats, one of the titans himself in his area of turf publicity, worked in ran the publicity office in New York and remained close to Bob for, you know, that was in the 90s, and remained close for years and years. And so Alan Gutterman will talk about Bob. Rich Migliori, of course, with his regular 10 o'clock visit, and it just so happens that Aaron Yagoda, who's one of Adam Coglianese's best friends, it just so happens that Aaron and Mig were going through photo books yesterday. And Aaron said it was unbelievable. He said Mig just remembering every single, virtually every horse that came up. So we'll talk to Mig, of course. Rick Samuels, another photographer, of course, whose work has been in that Blood Horse for years and years. Rick has got a wonderful story about the early moments of his own photography career. So first half of the show today, dedicated to Bob Coglianese, who is just, I called him a titan on Saturday. It's just a giant of, epic proportion in racetrack photography. The weekend itself, happy to be home, first of all, slip that in. And the weekend at Remington, Saturday night, the night racing, at some point we got to talk night racing because it's so unusual. You kind of wait all day to go to the track. It's just different. It's, so used to, going through the handicapping motions in the morning and, writing it up, putting it at the website, and then getting ready to go to the track. And even if you're only going to go for, the second half of a card, you're ready to go by noonish, 1 o'clock, give or take, depending on how you like to spend your day, or if you have, if you're meeting friends or whatever you're doing. a little different when the card starts at 5 o'clock. Now, the quote unquote good news, there was plenty to keep us occupied. Obviously, there was the double carryover in New York, and I did my best. We went 5 for 5 and got beaten that nightcap. That nightcap was such a murky nightcap. The maiden group, that maiden claiming group. And the wire winner, Saratoga Banker. And it's one of those ones where you sort of pick horses that have maybe a hint. I was live to 3 horses and for anywhere from 3 to 7,000. And I felt like I had pretty decent coverage. So congratulations to those that hit, because Saratoga Banker brought back 15,000. It was a very nice pre-Christmas payday, no doubt. But then we went to Oaklawn, played with Oaklawn, and that was fun, and then got ready to go to Remington, and ended up spending the evening and sharing table with the Milkowskis. CJ, who was on the show with us Friday, you may have been listening to the replay this morning, had a really nice time with the Milkowskis, and usually only see them in Saratoga when they come, they come every year, and so it was fun. It was like a home and home. See him in Saratoga, and then I got to see him in Oklahoma City. And, of course, the racing itself, pretty formful for the most part, basically until fairly late. And Rated R Superstar was a decent price in there, right? What a cool horse he is. What was that, win number 13 or 14? And then, of course, in the feature, which not that the winner was impossible. I had him listed fourth, as an exotic potential. Giant Mischief had trouble early, and to Florent Giroux's credit, he didn't rush him. He worked him into the race and got beat on the square, but if they run it a few times, he's going to win his share. But in the meantime, Wild Atlantic Storm, Stormy Atlantic, the pensioned Hillendale Stallion, gets himself a 2-year-old stake winner and an Iowa bred at that. Jim Jorgensen, a homebred of his out of a big brown mare. Tremendous. And it's been the year of the Iowa bred. Even though Tyler's Tribe, the things kind of went squirrely here at late stages with him. This is a terrific win. Ray Ashford is going to join us. $32 winner. Leon Goncalves aboard and was well positioned throughout and took over in the stretch and won clear. So excited to get Ray Ash. It's funny, I reached out to Ray on Thursday. And we didn't connect, and so I'm kind of glad. I'm glad that we'll get a chance instead to celebrate the Springboard Mile win with Ray Ashford. Big win. Big win. And this is a nice horse. And it's funny, I before the race, we went to the paddock, and Clinton Stewart kind of called me over. We were talking to Clinton and his pal, and then when they were leaving to go through the tunnel, I said, who you like here? And he said, favorite's going to be tough. He said, but the outside horse. I said, Ray Ashford, the Iowa bred. He said, yeah. So this is a nice horse. He said, he's live. Clinton could not have been more right at 15-1, the reward, if you went in that direction. So I'm looking forward to a visit with Ray Ashford and see what's ahead this winter for his string. So Bob Coglione's tributing here in the first half of the show. And from there, we'll get into the other action. Tim Yakteen. How about Yakteen with the upset? Slight upset, really. Upset. Just because Baffert was going to be a short price, didn't mean he was invincible. And haven't heard really yet what transpired with Arabian Lion. If he maybe bled, he kind of ran like he bled. But Practical Move at 10-1, that was a nice price to get Practical Move. Coming off the solid third in the Bob Hope, blinkers come off. And if you hadn't noticed, Tim Yakteen, 5-10, taking blinkers off with a 398 ROI. So we'll have to figure that ROI now that he's up, make him 6-11 with a $23.20 winner in a five-horse field. So we'll get to Tim Yakteen as well. Some interesting performers at Oaklawn. Plenty to keep us busy as we get going this week. First order of business, though, is to have Adam join us and pay tribute to his father and reach for him now. The morning, I knew, there we go. Adam Coglanese joins us. Adam, deepest sympathies to you, your mother, your son, on your dad's passing.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you. The outpour of condolences from all my colleagues and customers that Bob had over the generations is beyond touching.
That's one of the elements here that I kind of hinted at. I mean, the decades and decades of work, and the fact, really, Adam, that he really only, quote unquote, retired, 10 years ago or so. But basically, 60 plus years taking pictures on the racetrack.
Yeah. It goes back to his first day at the track in 1952. When he saw a native dancer break his maiden. I want to say that was at Jamaica Racetrack. Hmm. And he kept the maiden program of that day his whole life.
I suppose a chronologic review is in order. And it's notable too, Adam, that just the other day, Burt Morgan added to the Hall of Fame, the media roll of honor, and I undoubtedly, your dad is will go in as well. But it just so happened that the mid-century history of photography in New York was detailed quite a bit with Burt Morgan, and then there comes your family and your great uncle, I suppose, is right? Is the
my father's uncle Michael Sirico was taking pictures in the 30s, and then my father was introduced, followed his footsteps in the 50s, and my father turned it. He started turning the taking photos at the racetrack and building the collages we see today into a business. And he shot things at the track. It wasn't just your standard shots. My father was huge on taking shots from the infield to show the huge crowds at the racetrack. And he built those into the wind pictures you'll see in Saratoga, at Belmont, at Jamaica Racetrack. And that was part of my father's forte is making things unique. And he had a special way of really analyzing every image before they left the office. And I was taught that. And every image that I send out today is analyzed by me and is scrutinized. And I teach that to my staff. And that all comes from my father's tutelage.
And what is amazing, because you mentioned your granduncle, Mike Sirico, and Sirico himself had worked as an apprentice to C.C. Cook, whose name you see C.C. Cook on the War of on Man of War photos.
Man of War. Yep. I'm third generation, and it goes back almost, I want to say 80 years. 80 years it's been in my family. Amazing. Everybody correlates Bob with Secretary 1973, but there was almost five other decades that he has been taking pictures of champions going back to Kelso, the Forgo, the Ruffian, to modern day champions like Cigar, and celebrities at the track that were countless. And it's story after story he would tell people while he was sitting in his later years at my booth in Saratoga about the history of the tracks. My father used to tell me when we would sit at Aqueduct in the wintertime. He was at Aqueduct at the ribbon cutting when Aqueduct reopened in 1964, I think. I might have the date wrong there. But my father was at the opening of the new Aqueduct. And I actually still have a piece of the ribbon that that was given to my father that day.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
He was just a special guy. He taught me everything I know. And I came around in 1985 Breeders' Cup. I was turning 14 years old. And that's when I really got interested in it. My father put a camera in my hand. And I never looked back. But I didn't have it easy with my father. I had no family privileges. He taught me how to take pictures. He brought me out for all the big races. But he made me go to work at a one-hour photo. Had nothing to do with horse racing. I had to go get a job. I worked for a one-hour photo. I learned how to develop film, print photographs. So I had no privileges. And then I came back to work for him in the 90s and I just never looked back. And I've been taking pictures at NYRA for the last almost 30 years.
One thing, Adam, that is fascinating to me, and you know, when I have come over the years and would sit with him as you and Chelsea were busy working, and he would sit and you could ask him, I begged him to come on the radio 500 times. I couldn't get him to come on the radio. He was impossible on that front. He'd say maybe Labor Day weekend, maybe. No, and then he never would. But you would listen to him, and one of the things that really you need to laud is the technological changes, and I won't even call them advances, but he literally bridges the breadth of you know, photographic history and innovation from the single frame, you know, the single lens frame to the digital age, and yes. He smoothly transitioned, and he was a tinkerer, right? I mean, he tried all kinds of things technologically.
Yes. I got the tail end of shooting one frame a race. The cameras were not motorized. So in the 50s, 60s, 70s, he only shot one frame. You only had one chance to get it. You didn't have a motor drive. So that to me fascinates me every time when I pull out negatives of the scan of Forgo, of the Kelsos, of the Ruffians. These were shot looking through the lens and knowing what he was getting. And that was the end result. He didn't have multiple shots to choose from. And, you know, I quoted this. This was quoted in an article a couple of days ago when my father saw the pictures that started coming out with motorized cameras of Frankie Dettori jumping off a horse. My father, the light bulb went off and says, you know, I took that picture with one frame in the 60s. Of a horse called Boopers and a jockey, Avelino Gomez, doing the same thing. But he shot it with one frame, no motorized camera, in black and white. And it wasn't it didn't make the newspaper, it didn't make the magazines like these things would be today, but he did it in a very simple way. But with his knowledge and his expertise, he was able to capture the images you see today with one frame rather than 20 frames every second.
There was something not maybe a year or two ago. I put up a couple of pictures. Oh, it might be actually when I'm at Baltimore and I've got access to all those Jerry Frutkoff, you know, who was a contemporary and also a legend, right? I mean,
yes.
Somebody responded. I don't think a horse racing fan, but somebody responded to one of the black and white pictures. You know, why are you acting like there wasn't color film then? and I'd love you to talk about the transition, because one of the things that makes, and I know the Secretariat photo gets all the attention, but it's the Savage that is the picture that is the most dramatic. It'll forever be the most dramatic picture in racing history.
Well, people probably don't know this. Yeah, there was a shift in photography from color, from black and white to color. I discovered a couple of color photos of Kelso I have, but the transition happened in the 70s. But the reason we have a lot of black and white negatives and things were shot on black and white is duties at the track are to take the feature races, I mean, including stake races, and we would get them on the wire to New York City, and which would be distributed to all the news organizations. Well, to be able to do that, you would develop black and white film a lot faster than you would develop color film. Hmm. So we would develop black and white film very quickly and be able to make a photograph quickly and put it on a drum scanner, which would be sent to the Associated Press. For two decades, we would do that, maybe longer. Before there was a drum scanner, there was somebody who would take the printed black and white photo and bring it to New York City for them then to send it out to the press. But that's why we continued black and white for a very long time. And then scanners and computers came around and that simplified the process. But a tremendous amount was on black and white, even when color was in existence, to speed up the process of getting the newsworthy photos out there. So that's why.
There's a story there's a couple of different stories about the iconic captures, including how unhappy he was with the Savage at first glance, that because of the rail, the shadow of the rail.
Correct. He actually threw the negative in the garbage, and then he took it out of the garbage and says, let me make a print of it and see what it looks like. And then the rest was history. It was sent out to the news organizations, and I think it was ended up in the back page of the Daily News.
That's right. I've seen that the way that's been framed.
But he was so particular, and just he was very tough on himself, and he was always tough on me growing up, teaching me the business. That if it wasn't perfect, he would be angry. I'm the same way today. If an image doesn't work out to the fullest I expect it to be, he didn't want to give it a second chance. And then when he did, it worked out. But that's when you're really critical of your own work.
Well, and that probably leads. I mean, we're going to hear from two photographers that got to shoot alongside of him, that the respect for him and the way and the esteem that he's held in by the, you know, the track photography community and the, you know, the professional sports photographers. Skip Thickstein's going to join us, and Rick Samuels, and one of the things about him that is part of the conversation, has to be part of the conversation, Adam, is, you know, what was perceived as a gruff exterior, and you're even hinting yep. that, you know, that he was a taskmaster as a father and as an employer, but as warm and funny and personable and charming. And I mean, he was a pleasure to be around. And I mean, it made me laugh. He just had a way about him that was so winning.
Well, there was definitely two sides to him. He was very, exactly what you just said, but he was very strict in business. And he was very strict at the racetrack when people got in his way, because that came from his wanting to produce the finest work he can produce. And he didn't want, you know, when you have a big race like the Belmont Stakes and big races in Saratoga, and you and other photographers end up in your way, that's where he was tough, and he wanted to do his job and to do his duties at the races. That's what he needed to be that way. And we're all the same track photographers in the country. We're probably all screaming at people to back off, get out of our way when we're trying to do our job. And that's, you know, Bob was the perfect example of that. And yeah, he was no words.
I don't know if you saw, if you had a chance to see what I put up, but I knew that I had put up over the years a couple of pictures I took of him in the Saratoga, you know, photography office, and that quote. It just makes me. It made me laugh at the time, and I and Twitter was a perfect spot for it, and I can even hear him saying it to this day about a bit of honey candy, a bit of honey should be ruled off. It'll pull a tooth right out of your head. It happened to me.
You know. You mentioned having a hard time getting him on the radio. You know, it took Bob. You had to catch him off guard to sit and talk about the horses he loved, the people he loved, and it would change when we moved from track to track. When we were at Aqueduct in the wintertime, where our majority of our archives are stored. And I have pictures of the famous people he shot. And he always would talk about a picture he took of Barbara Streisand and L.A. Gould at Aqueduct.
Yep.
And he thought it was unbelievable that he actually was able to take her picture, and he had her pose with an Aqueduct program. And he says, can you imagine if I asked her to do that today? And he would always bring things up like that. So, you know, we were at Belmont, he would say, can you believe this? And Saratoga. And, you know, he used to say how the winner's circle at Saratoga was on the dirt until about 20 years ago, when they built the current winner's circle. He was standing out in the mud shooting the winner's circle nine times a day. And, you know, the environment he was in would bring up all the old memories. And it was great to listen to. And then when you caught him in the booth in Saratoga, selling the champion photos we sell during the summer months, he would tell the customers that came in story after story.
Absolutely. And then in your office, holding court in there, sitting in the corner there against the back corner, with his hand on the fridge.
Yeah, and that's the newer office at Saratoga. But the old office had a dark room where we developed film, and my father had a desk, and that's where he would build the collages, the composites of the photos we sell today. And those that was a process. And people don't know this, but the images that were shot in Saratoga daily were put together in Saratoga and then shipped back to Long Island to be printed. And then the prints would be shipped back to Saratoga under 48 hours, so people would have their photographs, because we We run at three tracks, and we needed to move the lab and the developing of film all around. And things got simplified in the early 2000s, but for decades, the process was a lot more involved than it is today.
Well, now, literally 48 minutes after it goes official, you can go over to the office and you're spitting out photos.
Yeah, people follow me back to the office. They give me a few minutes on a computer, and then their photographs are coming out. You know, that's a huge plus in the world of photography. But my expertise comes from learning how to take images without the digital camera, without the motorized, the motor drive of a camera. I learned on a Pentax 6x7, which is a medium format camera, and all I had was one shot. And that's how you learn to take photos. Not holding your finger down on the button is not photography.
No. No. But, what about the remotes? He had to be involved in the early development of the remotes, right?
Yeah, exactly. The remotes was shot on a one shot speed graphic. I have hundreds of negatives in 4x5 black and white film where you would have a plunger. It was not an electrical cord. It was a ball that had air in it, and when you pushed it, it would push the button on the speed graphic, the 4x5 speed graphic, which would push the release button, and it would take one shot. And you would just hope that when you push it, it's like when you look through the frame, you should know what you're looking at. So whoever was pushing the button had to wait for the exact moment to hit the shutter release. But there was no electrical devices back then. It was all manual cameras. And if anybody knows what a 4x5 camera looks like, the slide that goes in the back of it only has one piece of film. And the slide has two sides, but you can't flip the two so fast. So you have one shot. But I have a secretariat remote, but it's not the greatest. It's not one of the better ones. But I have pictures of Forgo. I have pictures of Kelso. Numerous ones, but that's how we did it then.
Speaking of, and we do have to talk about the secretariat shot, because as self-effacing as he is about it, and you know, whenever he was asked, he was up on the stand, right? He was up on the ladder.
Yes, on the photo stand at Belmont,
and had one frame to catch that.
I had one frame. And that was the transition. That was when Bob Colony's photos transitioned into color photography. So probably 50% of the negatives from that day are in black and white and 50 in color. But I think in 1972, which was Riva Ridge, those were some more color as well. But yes, that was in black and white on the other side.
Amazing.
And he even says to this day, if he had color on the other side, if he had a motorized camera on the other side, how much different it would be. Meaning it could be better. Everything could have been better. He always wanted to improve.
The fact is, and I know that you prefer to draw attention to, you know, so many of his other great pictures over the years. The timing of that shot with Turcotte looking back, because if Turcotte doesn't turn his head as the shutter clicks, it's not the same, and it's just not. It would still be a terrific measurement of the breadth of Secretariat's win, but what makes it is Turcotte looking back at that exact moment. That's what's special.
Well, it goes back to one of the first things my father taught me. The hand is quicker than the eye. So what you see through that lens, when you push the shutter, that's what you're going to get. So as a photographer, you have to be paying attention and knowing what you see, and that's what you're going to get. And that was the foundation of my tutelage with my dad. He says, pay attention. Don't shoot if people aren't ready. Don't shoot if the horse looks bad. Pay attention when the horse is walking into the winner's circle. And those are the things that he taught me, and that's how he photographed.
That brings up an interesting point. I mean, in terms of how you got winner circle photos and even, well, not so much presentation. It still had to be, you know, if the horse starts to move, if the horse isn't set, I mean, being able to anticipate that everybody is still and everybody is where they needed to be at that exact moment, because, I mean, now you can take 3, 4, 5 or get the horse to reset. But back then, no.
No, but you do, you have to have patience in photography. Today is a lot different than it was years ago. There's huge syndicates today that have 10, 40, 50, 60 people in the winner's circle. And I don't shoot until everybody is ready. And I keep circling that horse until everybody is ready. And it's patience. It's patience. It's looking through that lens. It's looking through that lens and making sure everybody can see me and I could see them. And that's when I shoot.
Adam Coglanese is with us, celebrating his father's life and career that essentially, you know, has dominated not just New York photography at the racetrack, but really the game in general, to be honest.
I have to tell you that you just mentioned New York. The New York Racing Association did a above and beyond for myself and my family on the documentary they did at Bob on Saturday after the first race at Aqueduct. Was beyond touching. I watch it. I've been watching it over and over again. The communications team, the CEO, Dave O'Rourke, I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, Eric Donovan was involved in doing the montage. It was fantastic. I have no words. I've sent the YouTube to everybody related to my family, and it was beyond. And his memory will live on forever.
Well, and continued through your work. I mean, one of the things about the continuity, Adam, that is really notable is that the style. There's something to be said for having a continuity of style and the composites, and it sort of lends itself to the quality of racing in New York. I mean, he protected that and preserved that, and you continue it.
Thank you. It's been a rough few days, but the comments that I keep reading on social media about my dad is just incredible. And it's surprisingly that I got a lot of people I don't know used to come by the booth in Saratoga that my father would chit-chat with and tell them the old stories. It's just, that's who my father was. That's who my father was. And he would just reminisce year after year.
is there, I know there's not, obviously, no services per se, but a memorial, we going to anticipate one at Saratoga or at Belmont in the spring?
I'm hoping we can do a memorial in Saratoga where his customers, my colleagues, photographers, we could do a gathering in Saratoga. And I think that's probably going to be best, where everybody would be all together, where this time of the year people are a little bit spread out, and especially going into the holidays. But Saratoga is what we're anticipating.
Very good. Let me also, for those that want to pay tribute to Bob in terms of a donation, the options, all obviously New York racetrack based. Who would he like to see donations made to?
The racetrack chaplaincy, the BCCA, and Best.
Very good. The backstretch employee assistance team, and of course the Humberto Chavez, the chaplain, and his great group, and the Belmont Child Care Association that does an amazing job. Adam, I can't tell you how much I always anticipated and looked forward to spending time with him. And the last couple of summers really haven't been the same without him there.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, and I want to say thank you to my current employees, my past employees. Everybody has reached out to me, and everybody in the community, in the racing industry, from around the globe. I have gotten emails, text messages, and it's extremely touching, and I. When I got emails from England, all over, unbelievable. I just have no words.
Then that is one question. There's got to be countless apprentice photographers that worked under him over the years that either went on to other, either sports photography or. Whatever kind of photography, studio photography, who knows, advertising. How many people did he train to go on into the industry?
Dozens. I don't know if they stayed in the industry, but they were with my father for a very long time. Throughout the over 60 years, he had employees that worked with him for anywhere from a few years up until 15 years.
Well, and you too, some, right? You too.
Some of them pardon?
You too. You've kept it, right? Chelsea's, how long's Chelsea been?
Chelsea's going on 11 years with me.
Yeah.
And she's the longest that I've, she's been with me the longest, and came out of college, and she's fantastic. Knows photography. I taught her more about the racing, photographing horses, and my employees all expect a phone call after a big race, and I have to critique their work, and I sit there and they get mad at me, but I'm because I'm so critical. I say, oh, do this, do that, make sure the horse looks good. I like to see what goes out to the press. I like to see what goes out to all the magazines. But after 11 years, there's really not much need for that these days. But my father was the same way. He would look at the picture the minute the picture came out of the when we made photographs, paper, and it would come out of the processor. My father would look at it and say, "Oh," he would go back to the man who was the printer and say, "You need to tweak this. You make it lighter, make it darker." So everything was always critiqued before it actually went out the door.
Yeah, I can hear you saying if they got upset with you, you're saying, well, you should have come up under my father. You then you would have been critiqued.
Right. Yep.
Adam, I thank you, and best to your mother and to your son and all the other, you know, the extended family. He'll never be forgotten, and the imagery. And that's one of the nice things about being an artist of this ilk. The artistry lives on forever.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure. And I'm always open for questions if people ever want to learn more about my dad, learn more about photography and photographing racehorses. They're always welcome to reach out.
Adam Coglanese, everyone. And, of course, down at Gulfstream and at the Naira Tracks. It's funny. I didn't know until I talked to you about a week ago, 10 days ago. How, you know, I knew he had taken the fall and had was suffering a little, but until I put up that thing about Christmas about, you know, Rich Migliore, who's going to join us shortly, Mig put up that picture of Gander, which had such great lighting, and
yep.
I said, you know, well, I reminded everybody that. You know, the Bob Coglanese photo website, you know, if you want a Christmas, what's better for a race fan than a picture of their favorite horse? And you told me that he wasn't doing well, and that just...
But it was very peaceful, so thank God for that.
Yeah, exactly. Adam, best wishes.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Adam Coglanese, everyone, and his father, an absolute legend. We're going to talk to Mig in about 10 minutes or so after we visit with Alan Gutterman. And Alan, a unique opportunity, actually, to talk to Alan because they co-worked in the 90s. And Alan on the... And it's funny that I had mentioned Alan's name after seeing him, you know, last weekend in Los Angeles. And as a turf publicist, obviously you work very closely with the photographer. And the opportunity to visit, I wasn't going to miss this chance. And Alan, I hate that I said to you, In Los Angeles, John Parada's last Saturday night, I wanted to get you on. This wasn't exactly what I had in mind.
But you know, I hate to say this as I'm aging very rapidly. It's just happening more and more often, and it's just sad. But you know, Bob was kind of one of those remarkable guys who. I was thinking the other day that after Naira put the press release that Bob probably had a greater presence and a longer life at Naira Tracks than any executive or any trainer or any writer. For decades, he was always there. And then when he retired, Adam is always there, you know, so he just was the quintessential good guy and never any drama. You know, we worked together. I was there for 5 years at Naira, from 1990 to 1995. And he was the most, you could always depend on Bob for anything you needed. And certainly on my end of things with PR and marketing, he was always always the first to help with any pictures we needed. He just was a very decent guy. And, it wasn't that he was overlooked. He just was always taking care of business and always doing what he had to do. And he was always there and got his job done. I was going to also say that he was, besides being very likable and very decent, he often created works of art. But yeah. Would never thought that he'd be the last person to tell you that, but within the world we live in and horse racing, he certainly did. Because the shot of Secretariat's Belmont is a masterwork. 31 lengths separating Secretariat from the field, and Bob very modestly said, when he was asked how he got that shot, he just, well, he climbed up on a ladder and and I took the shot, you know, and then I said, yeah, that's long before I was there, but it just shows you the continuity of Bob's career. That happens, one, if you're good, and if you're a good guy. And that was Bob. Probably an issue.
You talk about the publicity needs, and, you know, you're part of, you know, I won't even say a golden era. I mean, the turf publicist era is you know, really the whole century, essentially, all the whole 20th century. But there was a much greater call for, you know, coordinated efforts and placement in the papers and the tabloids and anywhere you could get, you know, you could get publicity. And so, you know, making those kinds of arrangements.
I'm sorry. I was going to say I'm from one of the last few eras where the media really cared about horse racing. I'm talking about the mass media. And he really was the I grew up in Brooklyn, and he would take, long before I was ever in the sport that I was so blessed to be in, he would take a picture on a Wednesday. These were during the best days of racing in New York. He would take a picture on a Wednesday of the feature race, and it would almost every day be on the back page of the New York Daily News on Thursday. And back in those days, you know how we transmitted things? We sent a messenger into the city, you know, and with the picture, actually. And that's how these things got done back then, you know. But his shots were part of life in New York. And he, you know, but he was just, I don't think we gave him enough credit in that the bigger than Naira was when his shots played in the New York media and sometimes in the national media. And it's just an incredible career and a great contributor to history of New York racing, and it continues on without him.
Alan Gutterman joining us, one of the industry's great turf publicists for decades. And actually, it's notable, too, Alan, that you worked with and were in publicity offices corresponding to what is generally thought of as the, you know, the greatest track photographers of not just their generations, but you think about Raftery and Bob Benoit.
One lucky guy,
right?
One lucky guy. I worked with Bob and Jim Raftery at the Meadowlands, and Bob Benoit and Ray Etta Burr at Hollywood and then Santa Anita. Yeah, I am. I don't take those things for granted, and how those people made me look good. And they enhanced my life and my career and what friendships I had. So, yeah, so Bob is, you know, we've lost all those three right now. I mean, they're all gone, you know, it's sad, but that's, you know, it's a different world now and a different life. You know, horse racing in a lot of ways is very exciting now, but I just don't think it has the tempo or the beat or what it was like back then. But, you know, I always have to remind myself, it's somebody else's era now, and they'll look back and remember great things that happened now, and there are great things happening now, as we've seen with White Line and things like that. So
sure.
It's sad, but it's also, you know, it was great. Bob, you know, we always talk about Bob with classic races, but his photos created memories for the owner of a $15,000 claimer, you know, that's just part of the game. Now it's his business too. So, it's a sad loss, but he left a great legacy, and I really do think it's extraordinary when you think of all the people who've come and gone, and at Naira, a lot of people have come and gone, you know, that he was the steadfast, always there.
I agree.
It was, you know, so for me, that's a great way to look at it, that he outlasted everybody.
And even, I said this to Adam just minutes ago, one of the things that's notable is the continuity of the style of the photos. And that, you know, you see wind photos from, you know, from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the composite, the layout, the style, the look, there's, you know, real continuity. Not to say that, you know, that you know, the work of other contemporary track photography lacks quality by any means, but there's also changes, you know, when you see certain photos, the look is different. In New York, there's this long horizon of imagery that has, you know, really Bob and now Adam's thumbprint on it. And frankly, the way Adam explains it, Mike Sirico, Bob's uncle, and then who he worked, you know, he worked under C.C. Cook, for God's sake. I've got a picture of Man of War here, C.C. Cook, and it's the same exact, I mean, the boom, boom, from, it's 100 years of the same style that works. I mean, and Jim McHugh, if you think about, I guess that's the only guy you didn't work with was Jerry Fruchthoff and Jim McHugh. In Maryland.
For me, yeah, it wasn't till Bob passed and I started, you know, you move on with your life and you start taking stock. And I was talking with a friend of mine and it struck me that, about Bob, of course, and then that Jim Raftery was, when I got to Naira, I mean, to Meadowlands, I was not that familiar with Raftery because he was a Jersey guy and a lot of other tracks too, but he was also, he was just a great happy-go-lucky guy and loved doing what he did. And Bob Benoit too. And even to this day, Rayetta, you know, and their staff there out in Santa Anita, This is a subset of our industry that I think we've all taken for granted. But that picture, 9 or 10 times a day, meant an awful lot to a lot of people who didn't have stakes winners.
Yeah.
And so their contribution was enormous.
Alan, I still owe you a call and a wider discussion, and whether it's in person next time this winter when I'm out at Santa Anita, maybe we'll do it then. But I knew you would have plenty to contribute, having worked, and then, you know, maintaining your friendship with Bob for, you know, literally another 30 years.
Let me know when you're coming out here, and we'll get together and talk about the good times, the bad times, all the times. That'd be great.
Alan Gutterman, everyone, just one of the most respected of his side of the game, the turf publicity side, and leaves and even had a second. I forget that you had the second pass. You came back at the tail end and to New York for a.
Yeah, well, I had moved into more. I kind of moved from publicity to doing marketing and created a lot of interesting things. But yeah, back in much later, Naira was making a move to a lovely lady named Lynn LaRocca, and there was a period where they were looking for some help in kind of bringing her along, and Martin Pants and at that time Chris Kay were there. They asked me if I'd come and help in a transition, and didn't take long for me to say yes, going back to working at a track and spend two Belmont meets and a Saratoga meet, few years ago was a great thrill.
Alan Gutterman, everybody. Alan, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Steve. Have a great day.
Talk soon. Alan Gutterman, and there you go. Another perspective, and I wanted to make sure to you know, have someone that worked alongside, in addition to, you know, shooting the action. So that was the motivation, and I reached out to a few people, and I'm delighted that we were able to get to Alan. Rich Migliori is going to join us for his regular Monday visit, and of course the last of the 2022 season. And it just so happens that when I talked to Aaron Yagoda this morning, that Aaron had mentioned that he and Mig yesterday were literally thumbing through Coglione's photos, and Mig, you and I talk about this all the time. Professional athletes, baseball players can literally remember every at-bat. Hockey players can remember every shift. Golfers, every shot they ever took in a professional capacity, and jockeys, almost every mount. And so Aaron said, you guys, you were like, you know, just, it was a magical walk through history.
It really was. We had fun. You know, the show didn't start till 2:30. I had gotten there at 10 to do the Blood Horse recap. And so, you know, we had plenty of time. He came and sat in the office, and then the pictures, you know, and that's the beauty of pictures and people like Bob Cagonese, you know, documenting our history. It just leads you into so many conversations and stories, and, you know, sparks the memories of, you know, people that you hadn't thought of in a while, and horses you hadn't thought of in a while, and just, we really had a lot of fun. I mean, we were all, and then, like, a lot of the people in our office joined in, like, they came in, and we all, you know, took this walk down memory lane. So I really appreciated Aaron bringing that book, and he's got more he's going to bring, and I'm looking forward to that. You know, it's funny, because I knew, you know, we're going to talk about Bob, and I was driving home last night, and I had such a vivid memory of the first time I found the photographer's, his office at Belmont downstairs, you know, near, not far from the jockey's room. I was galloping a horse named Crimson Command for Steve DeMauro, you know, just a lower level kind of horse, but he was, you know, one of my every morning mounts, and he won at Belmont, and yeah, you know, I wanted to start collecting wind pictures of the horses I was galloping, and found my way to Bob Cagonese, and I remember how kind he was, because, you know, here you are, a kid living on the track, making clear $91 a week, and he like would give me a discounted rate. Like, basically he would give me the photos for whatever it cost him to make them. And of course back then they had a dark room, and they had a, you know, it was a lot more labor intensive than it is now. I think that's probably a good way to put it, but you know, and Steve, we're at that age. We just keep on losing people that, you know, have made an indelible mark on our lives through, you know, over the last, you know, for me, 40 some odd years.
You know, one thing, I'm realizing now, I didn't bring it up with Adam, but what one thing about Bob that the jocks, there's some connection to the jocks. He liked to bet, and so he, I don't know. I shouldn't ask if he was pestering, if he pestered the jocks for, you know, for whether they were live, or whether it was, I know in some cases it was the valets that would say to Bob, you know, I think we're live in the sixth, and Bob would, you know, I think he was like a win place better, you know, type, or a win better. And so I should have brought that up with Adam, because I know that Bob, it seems to me that he went away muttering more often than he went away cashing.
He was actually pretty subtle about it. Like, you know, and you as a rider, you so appreciate when someone doesn't constantly kind of, you know, yeah, bicker you about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I remember back, you know,
walking into Belmont, and there'd be 20 guys on benches, like, you know, on the walk to the jockey's room, and everyone, you know, what's live today, mate? What are you going to win with today? You know, and I always felt a big responsibility if I told a guy I really liked the horse and they ran bad. I felt terrible. You know, and you know, the old saying, right? If you want to make the most money at the track, be the bookmaker in the jockey's room. Cause we all love our horses. We all, yeah, we're going to win this, right? But, you know, so when you did like one because he was so, you know, kind of honestly classy about it, you say, Bob, this horse is working really well. You know, that, and then that was always my way of telling somebody that I really liked the horse. Not that I thought I was going to win, or this horse is really doing well or training really well, you know, because it's just so hard. And how many times, too, like, I rode a filly, and I don't remember her name, for Rusty Arnold. It was Saratoga, and she was talented and smart. And with first-time starters, it's not just having talent. It's also having that mental, you know, capacity to do things properly and be professional. And I told, you know, me and Rusty both thought she'd win. And we wound up third. And we were like, wow, could we have been that wrong? Like, we got beat five lengths. Well, winning colors won the race. And winning colors went on to win the Kentucky Derby the next year. So, you know, you can really like a horse and be right, and just somebody else got a better one in there, right? So I always felt a responsibility. Let's put it this way. Bob was no Hattie. Hattie was relentless. Relentless. She was a gung-ho racetracker. She was wonderful, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to have those interactions with her, but she was relentless
about getting somebody giving her winners.
Oh, and it was like nine races a day. She'd ask you nine different times on the way out of the room, or, you know, she loved it. She loved it. I mean, and a true racetrack character. But you know, listen, I just getting back to Bob, though. I remember, you know, like I said, going and get those win pictures. They're probably someplace. I've got them probably in a trunk somewhere of those horses I galloped, and they were so important to me, and I hung them in my room. And he was so generous again about, you know, getting them to me. And you know, Adam's continued that. Like, when I've gone to, you know, Walk Hill to visit the TRF herd there, and, you know, I'll get the list of horses that are there that have raced on the NIRA circuit, and Adam just gives me the pictures so I can give them to the guys working with the horses at the prison. I mean, they didn't charge me anything for them, just to know, you know, I mean, so that generosity was passed down to Adam. I mean, and it's so appreciated. And, you know, I used to tease Bob a lot too. It's like, you got the best gig on the racetrack. You ride nine winners a day, every day, because you're going to be selling pictures to whoever wins. I mean, you know, it's funny. I was just the other day, I guess Adam was down in Florida, and, you know, Chelsea, that works for Adam, with the pictures, I asked her, you know, how's Bob doing? And like a few days later, you know, that, you know, found out that he passed, and, you know, he had been on my mind. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, and Adam, same, very similar thing. I mean, I had heard about the fall during the summer, and they didn't realize, you know, that there had been, you know, the condition was degrading from there. But something very similar had happened to my father, but it was over, you know, the course of years. But there was another very strange sort of, not a harbinger, but the other day, the wind photo with the seagull. Did you?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you realize that he won an Eclipse Award very similarly with a wire photo of his. I'll put it up. There's the photo with the same thing, the seagull at the wire. And for that to turn up 3 days ago or 4 days ago was a little, I mean, in retrospect, a little eerie.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. And, you know, this is crazy, too. It was maybe a week over a week ago, but not that long ago. Mitch Levitis is talking to me about that famous photo of his with the savaging.
Yeah.
And he brought it up, And then Mitch was trying to tell me, oh, yeah, the name of the horse was Carnivore. I'm like, it was not Carnivore. Like, and I had to go and prove it to him, you know, Carnivore. Come on.
Great prospect.
Yeah, exactly. I said, you're making up stories now. You know, yeah, it was Cannibal. You know, come on.
Well, and, you know, it's funny that because they sell, Adam sells and Bob sold more of the Savage than any, than even of the, than the Secretariat photo. And when I wanted to have George Velasquez give me an autograph, I've gotten friendly with Georgie, and
right.
I chose the Savage. I mean, I subsequently I've got pictures of Aladar and George, but the first autograph I ever asked George for was with the Savage. And, you know, for those that don't know the specifics, and there's actually another aside to this, you know, the 1980 Tremont and its great prospector biting Golden Derby, who wins. And Daryl McCarr is on Golden Derby, and Georgie is on Great Prospector. And George maintains that if Prospector doesn't do that, they win the race.
Oh, yeah, it throws the horse off that's doing the Savage and more than the horse that's being Savage. You know, even you go back to Saratoga with Frenzy Fire, he cost himself the race. I mean, just
yeah.
being so persistent and losing his stride to get at that horse. But, you know, it's interesting, too, to watch when a horse gets Savaged. The horse that's getting Savaged, they almost like you're not there. Like they almost their focus is so much more going forward, like
that's
to get away from it,
that's
than
true.
To like, you know, how about that horse several years ago, Let Good Times Roll?
Mm-hmm.
Phil Serpy trained him, and I was on a horse for John Kimmel, Casey Tibbs, and I'm going by him on the turf, and the freaking horse bit me. He didn't go after the horse, he went after me, and he bit me. And a couple weeks later, I ride a horse for Kieran McLaughlin, I forget his name, for Shadwell. And Let Good Times Roll in front, and I'm going by him, and here he come again, and he got me underneath the arm, like just like by my armpit. And the next morning, and I won the race, I went to Phil Serpy. I said, Phil, you got to let me ride this horse. I said, because I'll be safer on his back than, you know, riding against him. And so he let me ride him in Saratoga, and I won with him.
That's funny. Just get off and get out of the way. Well, that's, you know, and for those that have never been bitten by a horse, not so pleasant.
Oh, it hurts. It really hurts. You're going to talk about take your breath away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not pleasant whatsoever.
No.
You know, my most famous, you brought him up, Aladar got me when I was a kid and got me really good. I was working for Dr. Hemphill, and, he went in the office to talk to John Veach, and Charlie Rose was hosing Aladar in the back, and oh, man, that's Aladar, and I had a Secretariat t-shirt on, and he let me give Aladar a peppermint or a lump of sugar, and he proceeded to just bite the living daylights out of me on the chest, and he ripped my Secretariat t-shirt, and I still have the scar. I mean, he got me. I mean, really got me.
Wow.
And I couldn't breathe, and I'm trying hard not to cry because, you know, you don't want to be like a kid at the track crying, right? Like, you know, and I could hardly breathe. And when Dr. Hemphill came out of the office, I was like, well, thank you, Mr. Rose. And he's like, for what? For getting you bit? Like,
I've told this, and it's funny, the ripping of the shirt. For Derby with Sweet Northern Saint and Trombetta's crew, and we were all in barn 42, and Brother Derek was on the opposite, you know, on the back side facing Longfield Avenue, and I literally just was more or less walking by, and he lunged Meg from the back of the stall, came flying, and I mean, I got me, same thing, bit me on the chest, ripped a quite a nice purple shirt, and I was like just taken aback, and the welt I mean, oh, the welt lasted a week. That was sore from getting you know, that came with the mouth, you know, with the teeth up and the lip back and
they can get you. No doubt. My dogs are jumping into action here. You know, we had a horse when I was a kid, Steve DeMauro's name, Son of a Dodo. He was by Son Angela, yeah. Dodo S. He was a gelding. He actually was on the Derby Trail for a brief period of time, and like second or third in the Bahamas, second or third in the Gotham. And he was as tough and difficult a horse I've ever been around. And he bit everybody. And we, you know, we had cones and he'd put up a grate and I used to have to gallop him. And he never bit me, except for the day I got dropped by him, and then he savaged me when I was on the ground. But everybody would like try to like, well, we can handle Dodo, and inevitably they'd get bit, and he bit with intention. So one day, you know, I lived in Barn 46, and we had a day watch lady who had a little 3-year-old toddler, and all of a sudden, where's the baby? Where's the baby? And she's in Son of a Dodo's stall. And she's behind Dodo in the stall, and he's fine with her. He's not like being mean or, you know, the way he is with everybody else. But every time you tried to duck under the webbing to get in there to get the baby, he would pin his ears and come at you. And then the fear is he'll turn on the baby. So what we had to do was we cordoned off the shed row with 2x4s, like, you know, enough area. Our father went up in the hayloft. I opened the door, swung it open, and ran because he came out to get me. And the father swung down from the hayloft and the stall closed the door behind him. So now the baby's safe because they got the door closed. And then we had to figure out a way to catch Son of a Dodo so then they can get out of the stall. But you want to talk about horrifying, like, it was probably 5 minutes, felt like it was forever.
Well, the thing is, one of the strange things about rogues is that, and horses in general, they are really cognizant of innocence, and even, you know, even a bit of a rogue horse, you know, they'll put their head down for a child. I mean, I know.
Yeah. Well, how about with Cody Dorman and Cody's Wish? I mean, not that he's a mean horse or anything, but you see the way that horse is around Cody Dorman? He puts his head down to him. And this is a big, strong horse that's in training. A lot of horses, yeah, when they're fit and in training, they don't have tolerance or patience for, you know, anything. They're like all business. And watching that, to me, is really, I really get an incredible kick out of it. I mean, it's touching to me.
Well, I there's a picture. I've got a couple of pictures over the years, but my friend Susan and her daughter, she's in a wheelchair, and we brought her over to the barn. And Kid Chocolate, who was not the friendliest, Kid Chocolate, same thing. I mean, he put his head, you know, right in her lap. It's.
Yeah, horses amazing. Are remarkable. We're you know, we're just so blessed to have them in our lives, and you know, I talk about it all the time. I mean, I know how much how different my life would be, you know, without horses. I mean, it's just been given me everything. I mean, everything good in my life. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, where I live, the car I drive, you know, the tangible things, but how about, I mean, I met my wife because of horses.
Sure.
I, you know, so therefore my children, like, really, my whole life has just been, because of horses, that much better.
Well, Rich, just a few minutes to here to the bottom of the hour, and I know we talked about last week about discussing Madison Oliver. Maybe we'll do that after the first of the year. Maybe some quick year-end thoughts before I let you go.
No, I just think, you know, it was a tremendous year as always. I mean, we're blessed to see some of the performances we saw. I'm looking forward, you know, already towards next year. I mean, you know, going to be back with the Fox shows for Naira. my deal, signed my deal for a minimum 142 shows. So I'll be back to work. A little bit light in January. We don't have as many long shows. I think I'm only doing like 6 shows in January, but then it'll pick up. And know how blessed I am. You know, I'm just really, what can I say? I mean, I get to talk about something I love and I get paid for it. I mean, I'm one of the lucky ones.
Rich, what's the holiday plan? And I should ask you too, the dog, how's the dog feeling?
He's doing okay. I'm just a little worried because he had like a little fatty deposit, and like within 3 weeks, this thing got so big, so fast. And it literally, they took like a tennis ball size, and he's a long-haired chihuahua.
Yeah.
A tennis size tumor out of him, and you know, we're waiting to get the biopsy results back. He's acting okay. You know, he's not like, you wouldn't look at him and say he's sick, but his energy level's not, you know, for him. And he just had me completely cracking up because our dogs are not allowed on the furniture. Like, I'll pick him up and he'll be in my lap when I watch the Ranger game or whatever. I went out to the barn. I came back in the house. This sucker's on my chair, curled up like he took ownership of it.
Yeah, he knows it's all right. Well, the kids will all be home. You'll have a chance to have a collective Christmas together.
Yes, yeah, and actually, Carmel and I tomorrow. No, actually, tomorrow we're gonna do the complete menu. We already have like an outline. This is a big deal. You got to get it right. Then we'll go to Great Barrington to Guido's Market probably Thursday and get everything for Christmas Eve because they have an incredible fish market there.
Nice.
And then everything for Christmas Day, it'll be like a whole one-stop shopping thing. We'll get up really early, get that done. And I'm really looking forward to it. Obviously with Isabella, it brings a whole new shine on Christmas this year.
That's right. That's right. That's right. With the first baby's first Christmas.
Yeah. So it's good. And, you know, I think Maddie Oliver's going to be fine. You know, she's got some things she needs to work on. She'll get stronger. And she got to learn to keep herself calm. You know, it's easy with kids. They kind of get excited. And sometimes the best thing you can do is just be a little bit calmer, a little bit quieter, let things happen. Don't try to make things happen.
Rich Migliori, everybody. Meg, we will be off next week, our traditional Christmas to New Year's break. And actually, you might even get a second because, yeah, January 2nd will be off because that's a holiday. So we'll be back January 3rd. Might not, we'll reach you during that week, during the first week back. We'll do something.
Yeah, I'm going to work the 30th, the 31st, and the 1st, and then I'm off until the following Friday, so I'm pretty free all that week.
There you go.
Want to reach out.
Perfect. We'll do some eclipse conversation, waiting till after the Malibu, and see where Taba shakes out as the three-year-old group. You know, that's probably one of the more interesting categories. So, Richie, Merry Christmas.
You guys
Christmas.
Have a wonderful, yeah,
Thank
Merry
you,
Christmas
buddy.
To you, Tina, everybody, the whole family, and all of your listeners. You know, I get so much great feedback when I come on and we have time to talk. So all the best to your listeners as well.
I appreciate it. Happy, healthy new year. Mig has been just a huge addition. The Monday lineup, Rich Migliori, everybody. Mig 4450 on your Twitter dial, and we will talk after the first. We're going to take the bottom of the hour break, and I think it'll be our only break of the morning because there's still tons to do. We're going to follow up on the photography side with two very good friends and two fabulous photographers. Skip Dick Stein's going to join us, as well as Rick Samuels. They'll pay tribute to Bob Coglanes as we remember Bob. And that is a, I hadn't really thought about it, until that portion with Mick, but I got to find that picture that was circulating last week, the wind photo with the invading seagull. Or was it a pigeon? I think it's a seagull. And Bob's picture that is almost identical, that won an Eclipse Award. Crazy that that parallel. Ray Ashford is going to join us. We'll get to some of the racing results from the weekend as well, some of the stake action. Might not reach Tim Yak team till tomorrow to talk about the Futurity, Los Al Futurity. Little bit, you get a little bit of a Southern California respite here. They'll take entries on Wednesday for opening day, Boxing Day, December 26th at Santa Anita. So no racing on the West Coast for seven full calendar days. Come back on the 26th. I can... Yeah, that will save right there. Oh, I'll slip this in. Because we one stake we did not get a chance to sort of preview or mention just sort of fell through the cracks with the boys, with James and Shap both indisposed on Friday. But Paulo Lobo. Paulo Lobo. Tough. Good old In Love. Won the Prairie Bayou Saturday at Turfway. And breaks a year long. He was 0 for the year. He was 0 for 5. So nice that he gets a W here as a 6-year-old. You know, best known as Serious Miler on the grass. This was his first start on synthetic, and so I imagine Paulo, who's off to a tremendous start, by the way, at Turfway. He was 5 for 16 going in. He's had a good year overall. Paulo Lobo, he had a couple of lean years, weird lean years, and then got restocked with these imports. A good horseman. In love with that man, Corrales, Gerardo Corrales. Basically stalked and took over. And actually went off favored, but paid 9-12. Paid a healthy 7-2 as the favorite. And Cellist, that's Rusty, right? Yeah, Rusty, Calumet, was second and was rallying late with Chris Landeros. Racing's been good at Turfway. Let's take a break. Skip Dickstein joins us next. Pay tribute to Bob Coglades.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio. Here in